session on Senate Bill 401. Committee Administrator Marjorie, do you want to tell us what's happened with this bill since we last saw it?
Chair Duncan, members of the committee, Senate Bill 401, we last had a public hearing on this on February 23rd. We also heard Senate Bill 400 at that time. Senate Bill 400, which is related to, well, not related, but it's similar to 401. We're working on some amendments for that, and that's why we have kind of stalled, but it's time to do 401. There are no amendments. It just clarifies statute related to the Occupational Program Planning System. That's all.
Okay.
I move Senate Bill 401 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves Senate Bill 401 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing no discussion, is there any objection? Hearing none, Senate Bill 401 will be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do you want to carry it, Senator Courtney?
I'll carry it, Mr. Chair.
Senator Courtney will be carrying it. Thank you very much. We're opening a public, closing the work session on Senate Bill 401, opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 832. And we have some groups ready to testify. Panel one, Dr. Kohler, the President, State Treasurer Randall Edwards, Dr. Halleck, the Provost, and Doug Gore, who is Chair of Public Finance and the partner in the Otter Wind Group. Good afternoon, folks. We're pleased to have you with us to begin the discussion, I think, on what can be a rather interesting afternoon and on a program that can have a major impact on the state.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Peter Kohler, Oregon Health Sciences University. I will let the other panel members introduce themselves as they go, if that's satisfactory to you. I'd like to open the testimony with just a little background history on this particular bill and how it began about a year or more ago with the discussion of utilizing some of the tobacco money in a way to take advantage of the very strong medical research programs going on at OHSU and the real need to diversify the state economy by putting biotechnology in place in the state in a meaningful way. As you know and have been keeping track, and many of you have signed on to this bill and one introduced it, so I appreciate that. You have a familiarity already. We have done a relatively good job in creating some real medical breakthroughs. Dr. Drucker, who has created the new cancer treatment, has recently won another award, which he's receiving this week. There are two other major breakthroughs that will be announced from OHSU next month. In the case of these two, as well as the one with Dr. Drucker, while the health benefit has been retained for the state and captured in a very meaningful way, and we will benefit from that, the economic benefit has not been retained here. It is on its way to Switzerland, and we have done a great deal for the economies of many other countries and many other states. So the idea behind the Oregon Opportunity, so-called, is really to be able to build out satisfactorily the medical bioscience, biotechnology activity in this state in such a way that we can stay here with the jobs and with the value being created by these kinds of discoveries that we have at OHSU. The economy of the state is heavily reliant, as you know, on a couple factors, high tech and forest products and agriculture, and when these have their natural fluctuations, I think it's going to be very important for Oregon's economy to be diversified. Now, OHSU is a logical place to begin with medical biotechnology activity. Our research programs have been growing quite rapidly over the last decade. We create the intellectual property, which is in essence the raw material for biotechnology, and we're becoming recognized as a leader in biomedical research. I would say it's appropriate to indicate that we're becoming a leading institution. We are not there yet, but we're very close. We are operating, we think, in a much more efficient and capable manner than we did before after becoming a public corporation, something that you voted on back in the 1995 session of the legislature. We think we're adapting very well to the environment, and one indication of that is the merger with Oregon Graduate Institute, which is upcoming, And I understand the first run through the Senate had a 29-0 vote, so thank you for that. That shows pretty strong support. We believe that bringing OGI together with OHSU will really allow us to take advantage of the computer science, database management, and other aspects of their technology, which can enhance and move medical research much more rapidly forward. The genome project has come to fruition. We now know about the genome, the normal being literally 3 billion letters that so-called now are nucleotides that will be needed to be farmed, that will needed to be mined for information when we have diseases that need to be compared to the normal genome so that we can create the prevention or cures for these diseases. Once again, this is a huge computer science, software, hardware combination challenge, and we think the merger with OGI will help us there. There's some other words like genomics, proteomics. Some people are now beginning to talk about physiomics, so the vocabulary will be changing. But all these are looking at how the Genome Project is going to be able to enhance, again, prevention and cure in the future. Now, we have been doing relatively well on the research front, as you've heard, and I think the immediate value of the Oregon opportunity is going to be to bring more NIH research money to the state. This bar graph that you see over here is a representation of the growth that we've had over the past 20 years. There was a very unfortunate comment in the Business Journal last Friday that said that our research standings from NIH funding had stagnated at spot number 34. If you look on the back of the testimony that you have from me, it shows the annual growth, and we grew last year almost $30 million. The other thing that you should know is that we are very, very dense in terms of the packing of our research. We have only a certain amount of laboratory space, and we're well above the 90th percentile in terms of the research dollars generated per square foot of research space. So literally, we're limited in terms of our capacity there. That's another reason that our capacity needs to be increased and could be increased as a result of this bill. But our researchers do a very good job in bringing this external NIH money to Oregon to do their research, which then generates the intellectual property, which can finally serve as a way to spin out small companies so that we have the biotechnology industry in the state enhanced. We are number 34 among all institutions, and remember, we're looking at many full-service universities. We are number 29 among domestic higher education institutions, and our medical school has moved up this past year from number 29 to 28 among medical schools. Our medical school research laboratories are where approximately two-thirds of our overall research programs are carried out. But we really do lack space, we lack wet bench capacity, and we lack some of the very important infrastructure that's necessary to move our programs rapidly.
Dr. Cole, I'm just curious, how many medical schools are there in the country?
125.
Okay, thank you.
So we're up in the top 30 of the group. The way we operate and have traditionally operated over the last several decades is to be able to recruit individuals who are among the premier scientists in the country. They bring their research to OHSU, and they frankly bring their money with them because it's NIH grant support based on a peer review system that allows success of the top usually 10 to 20% of proposals submitted to NIH. So we're quite able to support very strong researchers, and I think Dr. Halleck is going to make a comment on that later on. The bond that we're requesting is a $200 million bond. With that, we think we can do enormously well in terms of our research programs, and we're also going to create value for the rest of the state. And later in this testimony today, I think it's very important to hear from some communities that feel like they can participate in this value as well. And some people have agreed to come here and testify for that. One of the immediate benefits that we'll have is the immediate return of NIH grant support to the state. So dollar for dollar, we'll have a 2-to-3-to-1 match of grant support even before we spin off a single additional biotech company. Now, if you think about biotechnology in Oregon and compare it to some other states, it's not even on the radar screen when it comes to the economists' discussion of what's going on in Oregon. Some of you, I think, Senator Duncan, you might have been at that presentation that was held at the zoo in Portland back in the fall, and you'll remember that in California, health-related activities were the number one component of their economy, and it wasn't even mentioned in the Oregon list. So I think there's a great deal to be done there. There are about 75 biotech companies in Oregon. About 20 of them have an actual product. Compare that to the San Diego area, where there are about 250. And part of that is because of the good relationship they've had there with research institutions such as Scripps, Salk, and University of California, San Diego. We believe that it's the job of a research university to create the new knowledge that has the economic value. It's also the best way to recruit faculty members. They want to be associated with the places like the Harvards and Stanfords that have these premier research programs underway. Nationally, the biotechnology industry is expected to grow at a relatively rapid rate. This will be something that will be very good for various parts of the country. And I want us not to be able to duplicate what happened with Dr. Drucker, where a world-class, perhaps Nobel Prize-winning type of activity is going to economically benefit another country. Dr. Drucker's activity is being replicated in our places by some others. We have a drug coming along that we think may be better for cancer treatment, particularly for breast cancer, than the current best drug on the market, which is also capturing a lot of headlines at the present time. We believe that this could be a $1 billion a year business for this particular drug. But if we send it off to some other country, they'll get the benefit. Somebody made the analogy again of what if Tektronix had sort of decided to send off their ideas to California rather than setting up Tektronix here in the early stages of the Jack Murdoch, Howard Vollum discussions. I've been around the state talking about this, as you know, and one of the great comments that came back to me from somewhere in eastern Oregon was this is a lot like selling raw logs instead of processing them so they have value locally. And in the case that I've made with regard to our intellectual property, the value is much more than that between a raw log and a processed piece of timber. We frankly have a multiplier there that's closer to 100. Now, the other thing that we believe is that the entire state can participate in this. I think it's particularly important for there to be activities statewide that relate to biotechnology. There's several levels. There are clinical trials. As part of the Oregon opportunity, we would have a rural health institute that would assure, in fact, that we would be able to launch programs around the state and not just in the Portland metropolitan area, although, of course, the metropolitan area will also benefit. In addition, we intend to have a content-based communication network, telecom network, that would allow us to link up the last mile linkage to places around the state that want to work on clinical trials. So we believe that, I realize that the money is considered fungible now more than it was perhaps when we started these discussions, but going back to the idea of the tobacco settlement, for a relatively small part of that tobacco settlement, and Mr. Edwards can, in fact, talk a little bit much more, I think, appropriately than I about the amount, we could, in fact, do something that would be very important for the economy of the state. The time is limited. We have to do something relatively quickly. Other states are utilizing tobacco money already to see if they can help biotechnology. Our advantage is the research already ongoing here. I think it's important that we not just sort of sit back and wait for 5 years to see whether it's going to continue to be important or not, that we try to act as quickly as we can. Again, we'll be leveraging this with private money that we intend to raise. And I know that over and over and over again, you and the legislature are asked, can we afford to do this? I think in view of the value that can be created, the benefit for the entire state, frankly, the development of a new major industry for the state, a really appropriate question, and I ask this with all deference to you, is can we afford not to do it? I encourage you to forward Senate Bill 832 to the floor with committee approval.
Okay. Before I ask for comments or questions from the committee, I do want to make two quick comments. And I believe Dr. Kohler has heard me say these, both of them, before. I think we've come a long way it was just a few years ago, when we were trying to get the Saturn plant to Oregon, and the Chancellor of Higher Education, Bud Davis, and I traveled with the governor to Michigan to try to get that. But we were flying on a private jet, and the Chancellor and I were playing gin rummy or something. But anyhow, at that point, I had a particular major problem going on in the state. I'll not mention it right at the moment. And the major problem the Chancellor had was with the medical school. And so in playing, we were gambling to see who had to take my problem or whether I had to take the medical school. Now, that tells you in a very short time, this must have been about 86, you've come a long ways when you look at those deals. And the other thing I wanted to comment, and I want to commend you and your staff, in my travels last summer around the state on the rural health tour that the Health and Education, Health and Human Services group did, looking at rural health problems in hospitals sort of throughout the state. It was amazing, wherever I went, in small communities, whether you're talking about Condon, Hepner, and places like that, there was so much comment about how important OHSU had become to them, and how the emphasis on rural health and what you're doing there, that they had not seen before. And I saw it in Southern Oregon, I saw it in Eastern Oregon, and Central Oregon. They're saying the impact from OHSU has made major, major strides in those communities. And some of them wouldn't even be surviving without the kind of help they're getting. In the nurse training programs, I visited those in LeGrand where you had things going. I just think that we need to be very cognizant of the major role that OHSU has played statewide. And I love seeing that statewide picture that you're doing, and I just commend you very, very much. I think
this
has the potential of a great deal. With that setting, anyone want to be critical of OHSU? Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question, Dr. Kohler, maybe you can answer this. You know, we deal with a number of these things with bonds and also things which the state is partnering, one of which we have a lot of them in the building, currently working on a rail fund to help leverage federal dollars for short line railroads. And I noticed here on page 2 on the amendments that you talk about, this is really important to help power the economic engine in lines 25-26, biomedical and technology research necessary to create intellectual property. And that the intent would be that would create potential wealth with intellectual property, correct? I guess, and my only question would be, just kind of from thinking on this, when I think about things such as our short lines and things, the idea they create this, they provide an economic engine. That's why we provide these monies to help them leverage federal monies to improve tracks and other types of things. But it's a revolving account, and after that is done, at some point that leveraged state money is paid back. And I'm just wondering, and you can help me with this. You know, if we create this intellectual property, and if we have, you know, as you know, constitutional amendments to allow institutions like OHSU, you know, to retain intellectual property and value, why isn't that there aren't provisions that if we are successful in this, that the state has repaid this investment from that intellectual property rather than so that we can continue to provide new bonds for other types of programs?
Right. We've had some discussions about how this could work, and frankly, I don't have a problem trying to figure out how to get something back for the support that this would provide. We'd have to build it in there somehow. And the payback rate does take quite a while, but that's no reason why it shouldn't be considered as something that could be done. As these companies become more public, it will spin them off, and there's some round of capital that's going to be necessary for that to occur. That's another place where equity could be held by the state or something of that nature that could result ultimately in a big payback. Some of these products could be so big the payback might be rather quick, but in terms of biotechnology time, which means you have to go through a series of steps, usually testing in the laboratory, then testing in animals, and then testing in people. But some of these could be big hits, and there could be some way to arrange something of that sort. So I'm not averse. We've had some of these discussions already, and we've been sort of scratching our heads about how could you build it in. I think our main consideration right now. It's just trying to get it started while the window's open and we can get it going. But I think it's worth further discussion about that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that is a part of the discussion, because when you have good things like this, part of the thing is if you have those targets and you have something to look at, and you say, well, gee, there's an investment for the state, but also return to state in order to continue to have these types of programs rather than have them dead end. I use the example, for example, Mr. Chair, about short lines. Well, you know, that one's probably a 30 years before you get paid back, but at least it shows an intent. It shows the desire to be not only successful, but that the program is worthwhile, that it can help fund itself, even if that may take many, many years. And I think it's also a good message that the program is good, but also that it at some point can be so good that it's self-sustaining. And I think that's just a good message to continue to send.
And have the staff ready for the next
project. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today a little bit about the Oregon opportunity, as well as how the state might engage in financing this project. I also want to dovetail on your comments, Mr. Chair, to Dr. Kohler for his leadership, because what you're seeing here today is something he's been working on for some time, to have OHSU continue to grow on the path you've seen in these charts, as well as to hook into what really is going to be, I think, the most and maybe the next exciting investments in the state and in the country, and that is biotechnology. And I see this as a unique opportunity to invest what is going to be, and talking to those in the technology field, the next revolution or evolution in technology, and that's biotech. The intersection of medicine and high technology is the future, and we should position ourselves to take advantage of that. It also seems that this investment would be very wise. Our economy is slowing. Investments in biotechnology could help long-term with the state's economic health. Intel has pulled back on its commitment, of at least temporarily, and maybe hopefully just temporarily, in a high-tech R&D facility, which would have directly employed thousands of individuals and created a long-term brain trust in the state. The Port of Portland losing Evergreen Shipping and its direct flight to Japan are also signs of economic challenges that we face. So I see this as an opportunity to have a footprint on the long-term economic health of Oregon. Therefore, this could be a very timely investment. OHSU is asking for us to enter into a partnership and to help seed this project. And I think that Senator Metzger maybe raises a good question about, in a partnership, we're taking risks, and should there be some other benefits beyond the jobs that are created here? And we could maybe discuss how we might do that in the future. And the state has a number of private-public partnerships. And in fact, I'm involved in a number of them. But this is a pretty large investment. We're talking $200 million. And I'm here to say that we should structure this in a way that's the cheapest for the state and the most prudent. I've been working very closely with Dr. Kohler and Jim Walker, who is the CFO for the organization, to better understand the investment and to begin putting together the financial package for us. The bill before you and the amendments reflect our work to date. Senate Bill 832 contemplates using revenue bonds supported by a portion of the state's tobacco settlement to finance this investment. These are bonds that would be backed by tobacco dollars, much like we've done with lottery-backed revenue bonds. The governor in his budget, as you know, set aside $10 million in tobacco settlement revenue to pay for bonds for this investment. Financing capital needs with debt is financially prudent. Tobacco revenues, in my opinion, is a limited resource. We should use some of it to make long-term strategic investments that will benefit Oregonians for years to come. I believe using tobacco funds for health-related long-term investment like the Oregon opportunity is appropriate use of these monies. As treasurer, I do issue all the bonds for the state and work to maintain the state's good credit rating. Our good credit rating is saving taxpayers millions of dollars over time through lower interest rates on the bonds that we do issue. My role in this process is to help develop the most prudent way to structure the financing of this project and to ensure a solid financial package and to maintain the state's good credit. That means that we should choose the lowest cost financing mechanism and to ensure that the project is structured in a way that the state's financial interests are protected as much as possible as this project moves forward. Now, the cheapest way for us to finance this project would be for us to issue general obligation bonds. These are bonds with the lowest interest costs associated with them. They're backed by the full faith and credit of the state of Oregon. Because of this, they're viewed as the most creditworthy, and we are charged the least amount on interest when we sell them. Again, want to reiterate, low interest rates translates to the cost savings over time. If the state, for example, were to issue general obligation bonds for this project for the $200 million, as opposed to the tobacco revenue bonds that are contemplated in the initial bill, we could save an estimated $70 million. And I brought a handout which outlines these two financial tools, one showing the interest cost of a fixed rate GO being at 4.81, and of course these things change over time, but as of today this is what it would cost us. The total debt service is the total amount that we pay out on the entire principal and interest on this project over 20 years, and that's what it would cost us. The last column, average annual debt service, is the amount we would be paying out each year for those bonds. And you can see there's a significant difference not only in the annual amount but over the cumulative time of 20 years of approximately $70 million for this project given the interest rate differential. Now the problem I have is I can't issue general obligation bonds for this program. I don't have the authority to do that. And hence we have initially, and that was the initial bill, had a revenue-backed bond by tobacco. I do have a bill in the legislature, House HJR 46, to amend the Constitution that would give me the authority to issue general obligation bonds for projects like this. It's a general purpose general obligation bond, which could be used not only for projects like this, but for schools, parks, any other capital need that the state is going to commit itself. It would, in the long term, save us millions of dollars in interest payments, and it's something that I'm here to ask when it does come through that you look at that seriously. And again, the amendment before you reflects that if we're successful in getting this bill to the voters and it's passed by the voters, that we could use that tool to finance this project. And in my opinion, it makes sense not only for this project but for many others down the road. You might ask, should we issue bonds for this project? Well, this question is asked all the time, should we go in debt? I believe unless you have $200 million at hand, this is really, quite frankly, the most prudent way to go, and particularly tapping into the stream of revenue likely to come over time from the tobacco settlement. One, it spreads the cost of this project over time, and you'll see time schedules for this. As Dr. Kohler laid out, it takes time not only to seed the investment but to have it come back and make returns for them and the state. So I believe issuing debt is an appropriate tool. Another question might be, can we afford to issue the bonds at this time? Well, the answer to that is yes. Through the management of my office over the years, we have seen our debt profile drop from about $6.3 billion 14 years ago to $2.3 billion today. We have one of the lowest debt per capita in the country. And as a result of that prudent management of our state debt, we do have a capacity that's growing. That's somewhere in the tune of $2.5 billion to $3 billion. Again, I want to say I'm not advocating that we go out, get this bond tool passed, and we start issuing up to $3 billion in debt immediately. But what it would do, what I am saying, is we have a capacity, and the markets understand that, and we could issue more debt to finance projects like this one. And again, I want to reiterate that the bill that I have in the House, HJR 46, would give me that tool to tap into this capacity. I just want to close by saying that OHSU does have a long track record of success as a medical school, a hospital, and a research facility. That Oregon opportunity is an attractive investment for the state to make. I'm working with the university to ensure that we put forth the most prudent and financially sound package for the state. I look forward to working with you on this bill and to get a general obligation bond passed to help us make an investment like this at the lowest cost to Oregon. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards. Questions for the state treasurer? Okay, thank you. Okay. Dr. Halleck.
Thank you, Chairman Duncan and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Leslie Halleck. I'm the provost or vice president for academic affairs at Oregon Health Sciences University, and I'm assisted by a very high-powered projectionist.
I noticed that when you get up.
Mr. Jim Walker, who's Senior Vice President and Vice President for Finance and Administration. What we would like to do is just take a few minutes to give you a bit more detail. I appreciate this is not a revenue committee, but and we want to make sure we focus on policy and program here, but I want to give you a little bit of the underpinning and the detail around what we're actually saying we want to do. First thing I want to show you in the first slide, and you have these packets before you, and there are 10 numbered pages, and I'll try and remember to refer to those pages by number. On page number one, you see a little bit more detailed version of the board that's before you that President Kohler mentioned. That is our research award growth since 1989. And I especially would like to point to the values in 1995 when we became a public corporation, which were approximately $85 million. We have doubled since that time in research revenue. So we have been growing at a very rapid rate, and now have achieved an amount of research revenue that really returns a very significant portion of, frankly, income tax revenue, and that's one of the returns that the state can easily predict in a very conservative way that this sort of investment brings. But to put that in a little bit more of a context, I'd like to have you take a look at pages 5 and 6. And then we'll look at 7 and 8. And pages 5 and 6 represent a very long list of universities. The rankings, and as it happens, from 1986, this is a coincidence, a happy one, but a coincidence that it's the same year that Senator Duncan just mentioned. But in 1986, which was a year before we began to recruit for President Kohler, OHSU ranked on the second page of this long list, number 87. In the rankings of funding of NIH awards per institution. So we were at number 87, and we had $12.6 million from NIH in that year. That was a year when things began to turn around for us. We began to invest in the capital infrastructure of the institution. The recruitment for President Kohler began shortly after that. And but you can see where we stood at that time. If you now look at page 7, from the same sort of data gathered by the National Institutes of Health from 1999, you can see that we are now number 29. So we've gone from number 87 to number 29. And by the way, the figure in 1995 when we became a public corporation was 57. So we've managed not only to bring in more dollars, but to change our relative position with respect to other universities. And if you look at the names, I know you can't read it there, but you have it in front of you, on the current rankings, you can see that we are among very significant research institutions in the country. We're also in heavy competition with those institutions, both for recruitment and for the award of further research dollars. Now, if you go back to page 2 of your packet, we begin to break down, and we have pages and pages of spreadsheets to do this in greater detail, but we begin to break down what we're talking about with this bond in terms of the state investment. The first, and there are two pages here, the public and the private component, because this is a matching concept. In the first page, the $200 million bond, we're talking about research infrastructure. We're talking about funding with $100 million of that facilities. Laboratories and other facility-oriented infrastructure to put researchers in and in which to conduct research. We're also talking about $90 million in recruitment costs and lab development costs, and I'll tell you a little bit more about what that actually means in just a moment, and $10 million to fund a rural health institute. If you look at the second page, and we'll come back to what those mean in just a moment, but I just want you to have a glimpse at the private match component of this opportunity. We are also raising from private sources $300 million that breaks down as is shown on page 3. It also includes a substantial investment in facilities, in this case a substantial investment in endowments that will generate income to help support the ongoing needs of this investment, as well as some recruitment and some educational investment, and an additional $10 million for the Rural Health Institute. If you could look at page 4 in your packet, it gives you just a glimpse of the a very conservative, and I want to stress that, projection of the research revenue that will come in after this investment, in addition to the approximately $200 million that we would bring in this year. This amount of research revenue projected to come in just from federal grant resources now is easily projected to equal $700 to $800 million, and this is simply direct revenue. This isn't biotechnology spinoffs or companies created. To take a look at what that might be, you have to go to page 9 in your packet, and these are very simple projections and very conservative ones. If you think a little bit about the biotechnology revolution that is occurring today, it's a huge industry and the potential to become a much greater one. One of the reasons I wanted to show you 1986 and where we stood as 87th and with a $12 million revenue is that we lost the first wave in biotechnology in Oregon. We didn't really capitalize on it like the San Francisco Bay Area did and the Seattle area, frankly, did. And the reason is we didn't have enough people. We didn't have enough science talent or critical mass of research going on in Oregon to attract those kinds of activities, to spin out those kinds of companies. We're in a very different position today. If you look at the current biotechnology revenues, they're about $47 billion a year. If you think about what's happening today between the Human Genome Project and the marriage with computer science and database architecture and biomedical engineering, that we're able to put together by the merger with OGI and the kinds of science we're developing, the projected growth rate across the country is 35% a year. That's a $70 billion industry, and that's a modest projection by most people's predictions. We've put down here, what if Oregon only captured 1 or 2% of that? And we're positioning ourselves to be able to capture 5, 10, maybe even more percent of that industry. These are the payoffs that you can easily project, even without a different mechanism. Senator Metzger is to project the revenue, the income tax revenue that's generated by this sort of spin-out company, the likes of which we've been losing to other states and other countries because we don't have that kind of infrastructure. We're now at a position where we really have the critical mass of scientists. And what I'd like to do, and that's all for the slides right now, but what I want to do now is just take a couple of minutes to describe two things to you. One, what is recruitment and what is a recruitment dollar spent for? How do we package those deals and why are they so expensive, frankly? When you recruit a team, a highly productive, cutting-edge researcher and their science, it's a little like recruiting a company. It's really not so different. You go find the best scientists you can in the area you're interested in recruiting to Oregon, and let's say they're we call them PIs, principal investigators, but it's the leader of a science research team. Maybe they're at Johns Hopkins or Harvard or Stanford, and we've recruited successfully from all of those institutions. Rating, some would call it. We would call it just recruitment, and it's best guys. But when you bring that investigator in and you excite them about your program and ask them what it would take to recruit them to Oregon and to Oregon Health Sciences University, there are several things they need. The money doesn't just go to buy that person. Most scientists care the most about coming to an environment where they'll be productive, where there are excellent colleagues with whom to collaborate and work and stimulate their new ideas, and a team of people around them that can carry out the work and the equipment and instrumentation and facilities in which they can do it. That's what you have to build when you talk about recruitment packages. You have to bring the individual, you have to bring their team or some portion of it, and you have to equip that lab. Now, scientists are an extremely competitive bunch, just like any entrepreneurial group. They want to hit the ground running, because one of the things we've done as a matter of policy, and it's paid off well for OHSU, is we don't fund research per se for our investigators. They have to compete for those research grants with the very best in the country. We fund the laboratory. We fund the environment in which they're going to do those experiments. But if you start funding the experiments, it's almost too easy. They have to compete to be the very best in the country. In order to be competitive, that means they have to keep that data coming out, they have to be able to keep doing experiments, and what they care the most about if they're going to move is that they don't lose time. that there's no downtime, that they can walk in, do an experiment, and begin producing data so the next round of competitive grants they're positioned to obtain. So when you're putting a package together, you have to have the equipment, you have to bring in the people. Sometimes we're recruiting spouses who happen to be dancers or teachers or whatever it takes to get that whole team there. We'll work with other institutions to find them jobs, whatever it will take to make them productive when they land. We don't spend the money on those things, but we do a lot of help in terms of bringing that whole team here and equipping them. Once they're here, they tend to generate their own support, and we develop pages and pages of spreadsheets, which we'll be happy to share with you, that show 5-year projections of at what point in time, 2, 3, 4 years out, does that team bring in excess revenue. But it takes that long, and they have to get up and running. They may be funded by a grant. Let's say they're coming from Johns Hopkins, and that team is funded by 3 or 4 or 5 grants. Some of those grants will move. And we're told by NIH we're among the best in the country at transferring in revenue. We think that's a good trait. But there are some grants that may be collaborative with investigators who aren't moving, where they won't move, and they'll have to come here and regain those sorts of support. They also begin to leverage the other people you have here. One of the reasons it's easier and easier for us to recruit people of the top category is that when they come here, they look at other scientists and they get excited. They say, wow, there's a lot going on here. I would like to live in this environment and do my work here. That means when they come, they collaborate with those people, and that leverages those grant dollars because they can together obtain even more. So it's a highly leveraged activity, but you've got to invest in it up front. So the recruitment package is complex. It's not a simple thing, but it's basically setting the environment for the activity. The last thing I want to say is just to give you a brief overview, and you'll hear much more specifically about the kinds of things that we're contemplating of the Rural Health Institute. Over the past decade, and particularly since the arrival of President Kohler, we have expanded our program statewide, as has already been mentioned by the chair, particularly in the areas of education and healthcare delivery. We now educate health professionals all over the state. We bring in expertise to healthcare systems all over the state to either shore them up or supply them with people or expertise that they need. What we haven't done and haven't spread as effectively is research. And there's reasons for that. It's not trivial to do so. You do research in a laboratory in a setting that takes a lot of infrastructure. But the fact is the time is ripe now to spread some of this research, particularly built on the infrastructure we've already built statewide. But in fact, the science is also very amenable to it right now in two ways. One, clinical research. If you are a cancer patient for whom traditional treatments are not working, it really doesn't matter whether you live in a rural community or a big city, you would still like access to the cutting edge treatments of the day. Right now, that's not true. If you're in a metropolitan area near an academic health center, you have much better access to the latest treatments than you do if you're further away. This Rural Health Institute can help that clinical research protocol entry for lots and lots of communities by tying it to the research that goes on at OHSU. The second way has to do with the marriage of computer science and the biomedical research. A lot of the research that's going to take place, that's really exciting in the next few years, is really based on having the capacity to do data analysis. As we build the statewide network, and it's dubbed HERON, computer people like acronyms, I've learned, and the HERON network, it will create the infrastructure and the capacity to exchange data, genomic data or any other kind, and to generate sites that are all over the state in terms of building biotechnology spin-outs and supporting the kinds of research that goes on at OHSU's campuses now. So we have an opportunity here to take this economic development tool and to spread it statewide in a way that we really haven't had in the past. I'd be happy to take questions.
Questions for Dr. Miller? Thank you. By the way, when you were talking about going a bit beyond, I was thinking also of there was a time when you had the conflict between the community colleges and the nursing programs. You had the 3-year nursing program, and I remember all those battles that were going on. And now I'm finding that, you're saying, and as I sat in your office, you're telling me, we need all of them. And we're working to be a partner and to work that all out. So I think that fits in what you're saying, too. And that's, yes.
One quick comment. Building out that the transmission of all the information, and we're doing the 622 issues and how big a pipeline do you need, or what we're doing under 622, is that compatible with what you're doing, or how is that?
It's very compatible. In fact, it complements. We're not competing with any of the projects in 622, and in fact, we've consciously not applied for that money so that others could. What we're building is essentially, sometimes we call it the content you would put on those highways, but it's also the connections. One of the things that we've done over the last 3 years is built with NSF money a hub that connects to the Internet to network. And this connect brings, which is just the next generation and a broader capacity of pipeline. This allows some of the 622 infrastructure to connect with that hub, which we've created, and to deliver some of this data across that. So they all have to hook together is kind of the bottom line.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Gill.
Thank you, Chair Duncan, members of the committee. My name is Doug Goh. I chair the Public Finance Group with the Iterwin Law Firm in Portland, and I'm pleased to serve as bond counsel to OHSU. And I'm here this afternoon to walk through some of the amendments to the bill and address any questions that you may have. Just to amplify on Treasurer Edwards' comments, really the amendments I think can be broken down into what we're trying to achieve is two things, and they all revolve around saving the state of Oregon money in terms of the debt service on these bonds. Number one, we wanted to make sure that there was the flexibility within the bill that these bonds could be issued on a what we call a tax-exempt basis. That is, they qualify under the Internal Revenue Code for the tax-exempt bond rules, and as Provost Halleck has described to you, as part of the Oregon opportunity, many of the costs aren't strictly capital costs in the traditional sense. They involve recruiting scientists and so forth. Those costs under the federal tax code don't necessarily qualify for tax-exempt financing, and so we've tried to build into the amendments the flexibility so that OHSU can achieve its goals of achieving the Oregon opportunity and financing all the costs that it needs to. At the same time, the state can achieve the benefits of tax-exempt financing. That's the number one component. Treasurer Edwards, again, hit on the second component, and that is having a tie-in from in this bill to HJR 46 that would allow the state to issue general obligation bonds, and that this program would be able to take advantage of that. And again, those two components, the tax-exempt bond component and the general obligation bond component, would give the state the absolute lowest interest rate possible. I'm just going to highlight just a couple sections that reflect that. Section 3, and in several of the sections you will see the phrase directly or indirectly was inserted. Again, that was intended to address the flexibility that we needed in order that the bonds could be issued on a tax-exempt basis. Section 6 contains a number of really what are technical and structural changes that as other states have issued tobacco bonds across the country, the financial markets have given us feedback that certain technical provisions need to be in the authorizing legislation. We tried to reflect those provisions in Section 6. Would be happy to address any of those in detail, but won't otherwise go into those technical provisions. But you can see kind of throughout there that there have been a number of additions. Let me just highlight again one to illustrate the point. Section 6, paragraph 12 and 13, item D was an addition, and again, this this is a paragraph that was, it's on page 7 of the Legislative Council amendments. This was added, again, to go to the point of let's achieve the lowest interest rate for the state of Oregon by being able to issue the bonds on a tax-exempt basis and providing OHSU with the ability to finance a variety of costs so that the bonds could achieve that goal. OHSU Section 13 indicates that OHSU would provide to the treasurer a report and the breakdown of those costs if that Section D is utilized on an annual basis. Finally, let me just comment on a couple you will see. I direct you to page 8, Section 8 of the bill contains an operative. It says that the Section 6 and 7, which are the revenue bond components, would not become operative until January 1, 2003. That was, we have conferred with Legislative Council, that was a typo. That was intended to be January 1, 2002, and just want to note that for the record, if we might. Likewise, Section 10, 11, and 9, 10, and 11 really are intended to address, again, Treasurer Edwards, what I think is an excellent financing tool for the state, that is HDR 46. If that was approved by the voters as an amendment to the Oregon Constitution, the authority would then be in place to issue general obligation bonds, and general obligation bonds could be then issued for the Oregon Opportunity. And there are, of course, some technical provisions of the bill that says you can issue general obligation bonds if the voters approve. If they don't approve, you will issue the bonds as revenue bonds. There likewise in Section 11, just again want to mention for the record, there is a date of November 6, 2001 as the date that the constitutional amendment would be placed on the general election ballot. That again is a date that I think that the Treasurer's Office and OHSU are continuing to discuss, and is something that we may be back to the committee or future committees with.
So as I understand it, you would be talking about having both measures on the ballot, about the same.
Actually, Mr. Chair, if I might, general obligation of the amendment to the Constitution would require being on the ballot. If revenue bonds are issued, there is existing authority for revenue bonds.
Okay.
I'd be happy to address any other questions that the committee might have.
Mr. Nelson, it's on one of these sheets, a 20-year payout, 30-year payout. How does that work, and what effect would that have on everything?
Let me address the bond component of that, and then if I'm missing the mark, Senator, we'll have someone else address that question. At this point, I think there is contemplated to be either a 20 or 25 year repayment of the bonds, and again, I think that the Treasurer's Office is given a fair amount of discretion to, again, determine in terms of that payback what is in the financial interest of the state and the bond, and looking at the bond market at that time. But flexibility is built within the bill to address that, again, at this point. A 20 to 25 year payback, I think, is what the baseline is contemplated.
Any other questions for the panel?
Could I just ask this?
Sure.
They all lawyers on the Senate University.
Well, he's the bond attorney. Mr. Coe is.
He's the last lawyer on the Senate University. He'll testify.
No. Yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. The issue of earthquake, well, where's the status of the Oregon Health Science University when it comes to the earthquake?
Right on top of the hill.
The readiness for earthquake is variable depending on the age of our buildings. Our newer buildings are very, very much up to code. The older ones are not. As we renovate space, we need to bring these up to code. So as the campus does get changed out, we think we're as ready as you can be. I don't know what size earthquake the codes are designed to be able to accommodate these days, but I think we're in an intermediate but fairly advanced stage of preparedness.
The reason I asked is the state treasurer testified on his the bonding authority he wants to do for everything. And there are two measures in that would put a referrals out there, one on hospitals and on the other one's on schools and fire stations. They're all ballot measures. They're all indebtedness. Now, the one he's talked to you today that I guess was tobacco settlement money. The other one's something else. I found myself sitting here thinking, I know what you want. I'm supportive of that. It's just that I'm worried about getting out there against one measure and all of a sudden being pitted against another. And the earthquake preparedness issue, which I assume you're interested in, because if it's going to be as great as it is going to be, Dr. Kohler, they say at a minimum of 9 on the Richter scale, your buildings would probably be affected. And I'm somewhat tongue-in-cheek right now, given where the fault is and where you are at. And so I just didn't want to find, I'm a little nervous. I'm just finding myself saying, I just hope that we come together in all this. I'm very serious about that because they're in a very desperate situation, these facilities. Everything we want it to do and it is doing, it is in a very precarious situation if you could see the fault lines right where they're at. It's more than they're on the hill. The fault line is almost right under them, one of them. So, you know what I'm saying? So I just didn't want to see us, and you can't answer this question. We got the state treasurer's big one's going to go on. Then we got these others where we're going to move. I mean, you know about them, you know, in terms of they're going out, but specifically target hospitals. And you're interesting because you're a academic institution as well as hospitals, so it's almost like they're double whammy. And that's why I didn't mean to get you off all of this, the other things you're talking about here, but since you're the experts, I just wanted to know if you could give me an update, and you've given me an update.
Actually, let me give you a little reassurance on top of the update. When we became a public corporation, we insured our campus in a way that was not done before, so that we actually are protected from all sorts of disasters in terms of being able to get back into business without having to go back to the state or anyone else to ask for money, because we're now covered by insurance for that. And I don't know whether what percentage we're covered, but I think we are quite comfortable that we are prepared for some disaster that might occur. And while there might be some time lost in the process, we at least have the money to rebuild what we would need. Does that help?
It helps. I did know you had done well, but it doesn't help because you're going to be needed desperately when it all goes down. And there's no way you can get back online. Given the hit, no, you can get back online, maybe not cost anything, but the need for your facilities now because of the crisis is going to be so great. I just soon have you not get knocked down.
So would I.
I mean, with all due respect. I mean, I don't know. You know. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You support that.
Yes, I agree with you completely.
Okay. Mr. Chair, ask one more question.
Yes.
You talk about Dr. Drucker and his procedure he goes through. Could you explain that a little bit more in detail?
What happened to him?
I mean, how does that whole process work, and how do we lose, and how can we potentially win?
What happened with Dr. Drucker was he has been working on this treatment for about a decade. He reached a point somewhere in the range of 8 to 10 years ago where he needed some chemical compounds to start testing with regard to his theory of inhibiting a specific enzyme in these malignant cells. We didn't have the people to turn to immediately, so he formed a link with what was then Ciba Geigy, the pharmaceutical company, and they provided him with a number of compounds to test, which he found the right one. But in the process of doing that, he, which is not uncommon, gave away the intellectual property rights to these compounds, one of which has now become Glivec, which is the treatment being used for this form of leukemia. And our intent in the future is to beef up our technology transfer in such a way that we're able to capture these things and not basically give them away for a relatively low price. A perfect example is Dr. Clinton's treatment for breast cancer. There's a pharmaceutical company trying to give her $1 million to give them the rights to this. You know, she's a single individual. Our property rights are split three ways, by the way, between the department, the institution, and the individual. But that's a lot of pressure on her. If we can build this up to a biotech company in Oregon or work with a biotech company in Oregon that's already here, making sure there's adequate venture capital there, adequate management of the company, we could build that into an Oregon company and capture that here in a way that did not happen with Dr. Drucker's drug. So that again, I think we will be preventing lost opportunities like that with this Oregon opportunity.
You know, I have to say this. You know, I've written to you and also told you your face how good. I don't think you can be any better at doing what you do, Dr. Kohler.
Thank you.
But I really wish that you'd bring a Dr. Drucker with you sometimes. I would have loved to have had him sitting up here. No, I mean it. And as well as the doctor who treated Lance Armstrong, who you got from the University of Indiana. You probably don't remember Lance Armstrong, but he's the guy who won the Tour de France. And his doctors came out and you stole him out of the University of Indiana, wherever it was, but you got him. I just really wish, because a couple weeks ago, I got one of your guys. I got a guy named Dr. Bron Goldstein, who you probably don't know, but he's your guru when it comes to pediatric care for kids in Dornbecker. And he came down and put on a PowerPoint presentation with Dr. Peter Quint from Emanuel. I got to come down here on a life fighting for kids when they're critically injured or ill, because we've had a terrible tragedy. And they just completely blew the committee away. They violated all the rules. The bill just went right to Ways and Means, which means I hope it's going to get it, et cetera. It was unbelievable. It was unbelievable. And I'm not saying you aren't great, but I just would have, I found myself, my mouth watering. I would have loved to have seen this, well, this Drucker sitting right here talking to us. And I don't know whether it's because that's forbidden fruit or I know how busy you all are. But wouldn't
you agree, well, Mr. Chair,
that's not a criticism.
I have some good news again.
Oh.
Dr. Drucker has already been here and made one presentation
to
a group from the Senate, and he is scheduled to come back at some point in the future. We'll be sure you have an invitation.
Be sure that this committee knows.
What about the Lance Armstrong doctor? Isn't that a different one?
That's a different one. That's Craig Nichols, and he certainly could be scheduled to come down also. We know your time is valuable, but we're happy to show off our stars.
You're the superstar.
You might want to close down someday and bring everybody down. Okay, thank you very much. Panel number two, Stu Hall, President and CEO of Liberty Northwest, and Jim Craven from the American Electronics. Good afternoon. It's good to see you.
Nice to see you all.
Glad to see we have another white-haired person. I have such confidence in people with white hair. These
are hair at the same place. My name is Stuart Hall, and I am the president and CEO of Liberty Northwest Corporation, a Oregon corporation. We are located in Portland, Oregon. I'm here today for two reasons. Number one, out of due respect to Dr. Kohler, who asked that I come and talk a little bit about the importance of this project. And number two, and I would quickly admit that one of the doctors previously referred to would be much more impressive than I am. But number two, because of the testimony that took place about 2 years ago where Larry Huss was involved with some of the processes of trying to get, along with Senator Nelson, of broadband in the eastern part of the state. The business community was extremely silent during that period of time, which I viewed, and I was in some of the chairs at that time in the Portland business community, which I view now in hindsight as a sad mistake, and I made a vow to myself that where matters of business long term were affected, that we should be here, and that's why I'm very happy to appear today. I have talked to all of you a little bit about the circle of success, which I certainly believe in and the Portland business community believes in, and that is that business prosperity is the gasoline that drives the engine. It produces the personal income tax and the lottery funds that fund the governmental structures and infrastructure which present to us the social policies, the transportation, the education that that yields a great quality of life, and that quality of life in turn drives business prosperity. And so if we are all working together, we have the opportunity to present a great outcome. With respect to that, I think we always need to think strategically with respect to not only what is today, but what is coming tomorrow. A number of years ago, Victor Attia sat down and made the determination that we needed another stool placed in this economy and went after the high-tech business. He was followed by Governor Goldschmidt, who did not try to trash those ideas, but simply built on those and brought new ideas to it. And as a result of that, we are enjoying the high-tech industry that we have today. We built off the assets of Tektronix and other high-tech institutions that had started in Oregon, and we have developed a tremendous base now, which back in the early days of the 1980s, no one could even dream of. That type of strategic thinking, I think, is necessary now. We are in some ways in the best of times, but maybe in the worst of times with respect to where we stand and what we're doing about the future. We have a magnificent asset in OHSU. Any manager will tell you that their number one responsibility is to manage the assets that they have and to capitalize on those assets. We have presented in the talent of Dr. Kohler and his organization and staff the wonderful things referred to with respect to the cancer treatment with Lance Armstrong and the cure for a type of leukemia, which I understand can't be proven for 30 years, but because it has to experience that time delay, but also the opportunities here with respect to breast cancer and prostate cancer. I know from some of my travels that, for instance, a week ago I was in Southern California, and there was a full-page articles in the L.A. Times talking about how L.A. needed to capitalize on the biotech industry and how it was in its infancy, and this was the time to move. And if they could, they could control this area. We have an investment now. I think that this is a fragile period of time, something that the state needs to concentrate on. I'm not generally in favor of government assisting in business, but I think that there are areas where they need to assist in business, and this is the providing the infrastructure here for a research organization. I listened to a Dr. David Clark about 2 years ago talk about the fact that there are more jobs created within a mile and a half of MIT than there are in the 13 western states, with the exclusion of California. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but he was a learned man and a doctor from Harvard and a graduate of MIT. But his point was that the research facility breeds new businesses, and it talked about the collaborative effort of having this synergism of having these talented people in one place and what that does with respect to the economy and the small businesses that grow to be medium-sized businesses that grow to be large businesses. I think that's extremely important. I think we need to lay the foundation now for what is to take place in the future. Lastly, I think that something has transpired here in this state that needs to be recognized, and that is that Eastern Oregon, and largely because of the members of the legislature, have talked about the importance of narrowing the so-called urban and rural split. This is an organization that has been sensitive to that, not only for the right reasons, but also because of the fact that there has been a plea in the state of Oregon and the city of Portland to look outside. That should be recognized, and although I certainly don't believe it should be rewarded on its own, I think it's a factor that needs to be considered here. This is very good, not just for the city of Portland. This is good for the state of Oregon and has a tendency to draw us back further. You've heard me before. I would be open to any questions that you might have.
Questions for Stu? Thank you very much, Stu. Jim.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Craven, representing the Oregon Council of the American Electronics Association. I come here today on behalf of the American Electronics Association and also as a member of the advisory committee of CROET, the Center for Research on Occupational Environmental Toxicology up at Health Sciences University, where For the last 3 years, personally, I've been party to see some of the exciting work done at Health Sciences University, and been pleased to serve on that group too. Last fall, our board, along with the Software Association of Oregon, issued a white paper on higher education in anticipation of this legislative session. And in addition to calling for enhanced investments in engineering computer science programs, our organization, along with the Software Association, endorsed two additional concepts. One was the merger between Oregon Graduate Institute and Health Sciences, and two, the plan before you today, the Oregon Opportunity Program. So part of our interest in that move was the pending merger of Health Sciences with OGI, who's been one of our industry's longtime partners for almost 40 years. But in other ways that I think many of us in the high-tech industry can't even yet foresee, we expect that our industry will become a closer partner of the exciting things going on in the future in biotechnology and bioinformatics and all that. Part of it is trying to stare into a crystal ball and imagine what the synergies are, but we do believe that they could be multiple in the following years. I think another reason that we endorse this proposal before you is just on the basis that it's a bold move. And I think bold moves have become too rare of a commodity in this state in the last few years. And when you think of back and some of the history that Stu recalled, 20 years ago, high technology was a fairly modest industry in this state. We had Tektronix and Electroscientific had been here for 30 years. Intel and Hewlett-Packard had just come to the state in 75 and 76. And then in the administrations of Vicatia, I think initially, if you recall back in history, Governor calling a special session of the legislature to do a one-day thing, repeal Oregon's unitary tax, because his good friend, Mr. Sony, and there actually is a Mr. Sony, told him if Oregon takes that move, Asian high-tech companies will come here. And the legislature convened, passed the bill, and it became true. And partly by having Intel and Hewlett-Packard pre-qualify Oregon and to see the investment coming from Japan, it's really what caused the high-tech industry to take off in the state. So it was a bold move. It was visionary. There was no promise of success that if you do it, absolutely. But there were good indications and good signs that if you took a bold step, that good things would happen in the future. And I think we saw similar steps in the administrations of Governor Goldschmidt and Governor Roberts to send signals to the high-tech industry that the state was open for business. So I really think that's what you have here today, a chance to make an investment, send a signal, take a bold step, and hopefully reap the benefits in the future. I just want to mention one thing about the dollar amounts, either $200 million state or $500 million in the whole package. It does sound like a large amount of money, and for all of us as individuals, it certainly is. But the steps that Oregon took to diversify its economy and attract the high-tech industry to this state, in the period of just 1993 to 1998, our industry invested $12 billion in capital resources in this state in Southwest Washington. Now, you can't necessarily promise similar amounts because the semiconductor industry builds the most expensive buildings on earth. But $12 billion of capital spending in a very short period of time is somewhat of this type of scale that can happen when people get serious about a state as a place to do business. So we endorse Senate Bill 832 and wish it well. Thank you.
Questions for Jim? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Mr. Chair, can I just for Stuart's benefit, I want to thank you. You mentioned the involvement of the Portland business community and going back in 622 when Larry Hess was doing that here. I do really appreciate the fact that you've taken the time and the effort to come down here and do those things because it is very important. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, all right. Panel number three. And these are people who've traveled from some distance, so we're glad to be able to get you on in plenty of time. Dan Brosi from the Chemica Technologies, right? And Ben. Mary Decker, North Lincoln Health District Board. Hello there.
Hello.
And Wes, is it Hare or Har?
It's Hare, like
Rand. Hare, right, okay. The city manager from LeGrand.
Thank you, folks. He's a constituent, so be nice to him.
I'll be nice to them. We would be nice to them, even if they weren't. Good afternoon. Who's going to start?
Okay.
Thank you. Identify yourself then for the record.
Yes, my name is Dan Brosi, for the record. Thank you, Chairman Duncan. And thank you for allowing me to represent the bioscience business community in this forum. I believe I'm probably the only representative of what stands to benefit in a big way from the Oregon opportunity. I'm Chairman and President of Chemica Technologies, a bioscience company located in Bend. I'm going to speak for just a minute about our company and what we do, because I believe that we represent what the Oregon opportunity is intended to produce and reproduce within the state of Oregon, in the rural areas as well as in the Portland metropolitan area. Our company's mission is to develop life-changing pharmaceutical products and therapies. We employ chemists, biochemists, chemical engineers, microbiologists, but we are a small business, and we are located in Bend. And people wonder how we can do this in Bend, Oregon. Pharmaceutical companies that are our customers ask, where is Bend? And some of them ask, where is Oregon? As we develop a relationship with OHSU, and our company does have a strong relationship, it raises the stature of our company as well as our region. Let me say a bit about how we develop products. We develop it through internally funded research, through government grants, and through collaborative research with other companies and contracts. Our government grant research is funded through the SBIR program, the Small Business Innovative Research Program. And let me say a bit about this, because I think it's important as another way to leverage the money that the Oregon opportunity would bring into OHSU. The SBIR program was mandated by Congress around 20 years ago, and it was just reauthorized in the last fiscal year. And it sets aside approximately 3% of all federal intramural research funds to go to small businesses throughout the country. That's a lot of money. It's a very lot of money. We don't get as much as we should in Oregon. We do have a number of companies that are successful. Ours is one in reaping these SBIR funds, and most of it that we get is through the NIH. But we can get a lot more, and we heard a number of multiplier 3, but we can make that multiplier much larger by bringing in more federal funds through the SBIR program. This 3% goes to businesses alone. It's taken away from the universities, medical schools, and national labs to go to businesses. Let me say something about our relationship with OHSU. We consider OHSU to be a very strategic partner of ours. We subcontract work to OHSU. We work together on SBIR grants. If we're the prime contractor, they are a subcontractor in some cases. In some cases, they subcontract to us. We work with their PI, and they need chemical work done, and they look to us to help them. We work collaboratively in publishing papers. We work collaboratively in other projects. Some of the most exciting work that we have ongoing right now is development of an anti-tuberculosis drug. It's in the very early trials, but a small company like ours has no way to do this without collaborating with a medical school. It's working with biohazard materials, tuberculosis cells. Eventually, it will need to work with animal facilities. And so we work very closely with researchers up on the hill to do that work. We just could not possibly do it without OHSU. But I should say we also collaborate with other universities throughout the nation. We have a subcontract on a grant with the University of Kentucky for animal testing. We work closely with researchers at University of Texas. We would like to do all of that in Oregon, believe me. But some researchers just aren't there that we need, or sometimes the equipment is not there that we need. But we like our relationship with OHSU, and we see this Oregon opportunity as providing a means to do even more collaboration within the state. Dr. Kohler mentioned briefly the genomic project and the proteomic project. As I was driving over from Bend around noon, Science Friday was on NPR. They were talking about proteomics, and it's a word that many of us have not heard, but it's hit the news. It's on Science Friday.
Why don't you spell it just for
proteomics. And proteomics is simply taking what we know about the human genome from the Human Genome Project, which we all have heard about, and translating that into proteins. Proteins are produced by genes, and proteins are the target of drug molecules. We need to take what we've learned about genomics and now learn more about proteins. Each gene might produce multiple proteins, but the proteins are changed after they're expressed. And we need to now discover what are these proteins, what are these target molecules. And it's been said that we've only seen the tip of the iceberg on all the work that needs to be done. And I know part of the intention of the Oregon Opportunity is to proceed and move into proteomics for the purpose of drug discovery. Another opportunity that was mentioned is the Rural Health Research Institute, and we believe this is something that's very important, especially for those of us outside of the Portland metropolitan area. We'd love to see it located in Central Oregon, but we believe that this institute will be tasked with collaboration with small rural biotech companies like ours. We hope that it will house sophisticated scientific equipment that we can share with other companies as well as with scientists at OHSU. We know from what we've heard that it will coordinate the clinical testing of drugs that come from companies like ours as we develop them. Most importantly, though, it will facilitate the scientific interchange between OHSU scientists and scientists at our company. We heard previously how hard it is to recruit and what's necessary to recruit. Well, that goes not only just for universities and medical schools, but also for businesses. We have a number of PhD scientists. They want the facilities. They want the other scientists they can interact with. Having a stronger OHSU really does help us and other bioscience companies like ours. To conclude, let me summarize my vision that I have for the future, both for our company, for Central Oregon, for the state of Oregon, and for OHSU. I like to dream, so allow me to do that for a bit right here. I envision our company of 17 employees as being a fledgling pharmaceutical company. We've got a long ways to go, but this is my dream. Located in Bend, Oregon, people will hear about Bend, Oregon someday, not only for Mount Bachelor. In 10 years, I see our company expanding from 17 employees, scientists, to 250 scientists. I see us on a research campus with labs, with housing for OHSU scientists who want to come to Central Oregon to ski as well as to work with Chemica Technologies. I see that these laboratory facilities will be shared by OHSU scientists as well as our scientists. And I see that the Rural Health Institute will be a key component, possibly housed on this campus, for doing the testing and the clinical trials of the drug candidates that come out of our company and OHSU. We're the first of many bioscience companies who will benefit from OHSU being launched into the top tier of the research medical schools throughout the world. I strongly encourage you to support the Oregon Opportunity. I support it. I thank you, and I'm open to any questions.
Well, thank you for your testimony. I think it's kind of exciting to see the possibilities.
Mr. Chair, just a question. A definition on bioscience, how big is that? Is it just huge?
Well,
is there a specific way you can define it?
I don't have specific numbers for you right now. Bioscience, biotechnology are often used interchangeably. In Oregon, if I look at Central Oregon, because that's what I know the best, we probably have on the order of a dozen companies that are doing this. People don't necessarily think of Central Oregon as a high-tech area, but when they do, they think of software. But we have a number of companies. Bend Research was one of the first in Central Oregon to start doing biotechnology, bioscience. They are now dominated by Pfizer. Pfizer is a major shareholder, and I believe probably 90% of their research, of their work, is funded by Pfizer. And a lot of companies like my own came from people who were at Bend Research. I started there in 1985, and I started this company 10 years ago. So it's a multiplying effect. You've seen it in the Portland area with the electronics industry. It's happening all over the world that you're getting multiplication of companies like ours, and it's not necessarily limited to metropolitan areas, because with information technology being able to flow like it is, it can happen anywhere. But sorry, I don't have specific numbers for you.
Other questions for them? Thank you very much. Very interesting.
I'm Mary Decker. I'm from Lincoln County, and I'm a member of the North Lincoln Health District Board of Trustees. We have recently affiliated with Samaritan Health Services, and we see an expanded future for healthcare in Lincoln County. We also are excited about being part of this vision, and we see it as development for our community, as well as improving health care on the coast. And I think I can speak reasonably for the coastal communities. We share a lot of the same issues. We're not as far away as Eastern Oregon, but the Coast Range is a barrier to access to the amenities and the services in the valley, and it limits very much what is available to us. Dr. Kohler shared this vision at a meeting which I attended as a member of the Area Health Education Center's statewide advisory committee. And he talked about the potential of this, and it was quite exciting to our committee. I can say I've been around long enough during my work life where I was in Santa Clara County when Frederick Terman began the engines that started Silicon Valley. I was at UCSD when Jonas Salk and Roger Revelle and William Nirenberg began the scientific expansion that took a seaside resort town of La Jolla and made it into one of the scientific centers of California. I think that what I envision from what Dr. Kohler has projected for us is that kind of phenomena can come to Oregon, and we can do it the Oregon way. I don't think anyone wants to see the congestion of California and the wall-to-wall of anything and two-hour commutes, because that would defeat a lot of what we envision happening. But with the telecommunication capability that is now available to all of us and the fiber optics, I think that we can have scientists in our community, or we can have consultations in our community that have never been available before. Apropos of that, we invited Dr. Kohler to come down and meet with leaders of our community. And I think this is something that could probably happen all over the state. We had about 40 people who came, and they heard the vision, and they could begin to see how our community could adapt to that. And we formed a steering group and began to propose how the city could help, how the county could help, how the economic alliance could help, how the telecommunications people could help. And we began to develop a plan. We have submitted a grant to the Department of Agriculture Rural Utilities Service as one concrete example of what we could do to improve our connectivity, which is one of the criteria, I think, for having anything happen with us. Our school district and our community college are prepared to help develop the workforce. And again, this is not a unique capability for Lincoln City. Any community can do this, but to have this as an organizing dream, I think, is a very powerful thing. We, when you look at the material that I have submitted, we named our grant proposal LC2, Lincoln City to Regional Medical Network, and that is opposed to LC1, which is a tourism model. And as you know, Lincoln City was recently identified as the primary tourism destination in the state of Oregon, or the beach destination. But I think that's a very limiting kind of economy. It has a seasonal economy. The wages are low. Our average wage is in the 20,000s, and the kind of folks who would be able to come with these laboratories and the support services would average about $50,000. We need that for our infrastructure. Our statistics in economics are low. Our statistics in pathology are high. And so we need to really work on our community development, and we see this as a way of bringing health to our community and to other communities throughout the state. So we support Senate Bill 832, and we encourage you to do the same.
Okay, thank you very much. Questions for Mrs. Decker? Okay. Yes, go right ahead, Wes.
Thank you. My name is Wes Hare. I'm the city manager in LeGrand. And some of you may be wondering why the city manager of LeGrand would be here testifying in favor of a bill that's being sponsored by Oregon Health Sciences University in Portland. And for me, the issue is prosperity. In Union County, where I live, we rank 27th among the counties in the state of Oregon in per capita and median household income. And if you're wondering who might be below us among the 36 counties, it's mostly other counties in eastern Oregon. And so our issue is trying to focus on growing higher wage jobs. And we've put a lot of effort into that over the past few years. We've invested heavily in telecommunications, and thanks to Senator Nelson's help, have been able to make some good progress in that arena. We believe that the Oregon opportunity represents another avenue toward prosperity, toward growing higher wage jobs in our region. In LeGrand specifically, there are a couple of things that relate to the initiative. The first is the construction of a new science building at Eastern Oregon University, which would include, if this is approved, two incubator laboratories that would allow for fledgling companies to make use of the facilities at the university and to also make use of the resources of Oregon Health Sciences University. To further that end, the city of LeGrand and Union County this week are in the process of closing a deal on 15 acres in our urban growth boundary to create a technology park, which will take advantage of our telecommunications infrastructure, also hopefully will take advantage of our ties to both Eastern Oregon University and Oregon Health Sciences University. So we see this initiative, the Oregon Opportunity, as an investment not only in urban prosperity, but also as an investment in rural prosperity. We think that if we don't act, that we will accept by default blight and decline, and that we will fail to capitalize on our greatest resource, which is our human resources. And so we in LeGrand, on behalf of folks who live in our region, strongly support Senate Bill 832 and hope you will do likewise.
Thank you. Questions? No questions. Well, I think you've helped paint the picture that we're talking about, an Oregon opportunity, the total Oregon. So I appreciate you being here today. Thank you very much. Any other questions or comments from the committee?
This topic.
Well, we do have the amendment. There is a technical problem with the amendment. You recall the date, the typographical error that appeared on that.
Is it only a typo? We could do a typo. Come on.
I think we're going to break with
roll in this
rules just a little bit. We're going to deal with a conceptual amendment, which, of course, our committee administrator does create a lot of challenges for her.
Yeah?
But I think I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 832. Right. I'm going to open a work session on 832. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I'll just make a generic motion on the technical amendment.
Okay.
I move that we technically amend Senate Bill 832 in the following particulars. She's going to have it. I don't know.
Chair Duncan, members of the committee, I think it would be in your best interest to suspend the rules to conceptually amend Senate Bill, the amendment
Mr. Chairman, move to suspend rules to essentially finance Senate Bill 832.
Senator Courtney has moved that we suspend the rules. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Why don't you tell me what I'm doing here? I turn to the amendment so I don't have substitution.
Chair Duncan, members of the committee, I think you can conceptually amend the amendment.
Senator Courtney conceptually amends the amendment, changing the date from 203 to 202.
That's on
in section,
section 8,
section
page 8.
8, line 15. So the January 1, 2003 would be changed to 2002. That's the conceptual amendment. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. We have adopted the conceptual amendment. Senator Courtney.
Mr. Chairman, move Senate Bill 832 is amended.
No, we have to do the amendment now.
Is there another? Is there another one? Dave, do you see something there?
I found page 9.
Oh, that's for it.
No.
No page 9.
No.
We just need 9. We just need the amendment move now.
All right.
Chair, I move the conceptual amendment.
You move the amendment. As conceptual.
We're doing things we don't do judiciary. Mr. Chair, I move the amendment. Is that what you want? To Senate Bill 832, the conceptual amendment to Senate Bill 832.
Senator Courtney moves the conceptual amendment to Amendment 1 to Senate Bill 832. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Now, Senator Courtney.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 832 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moved to revenue.
Dash to
refer to revenue. You're doing fine.
You're doing wonderful.
Hey, you're going to stay in this process a little longer, you're going to get it down.
We don't do this in judiciary. We go right to the floor. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 82 as amended to the the Senate. You want the Senate or you want the House?
Senate.
Do you want, which revenue committee do you want it to go to, Mr. Chair?
Well, let's go with the Senate.
To the Senate Revenue Committee.
Senator Courtney moves that Senate Bill 832 as amended be sent to Revenue Committee. Is there any discussion?
Those are the dash two amendments is what we're talking about.
That's conceptual amendment, yes. Mm-hmm. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. So ordered 832 will be referred to, as amended, will be referred to the Senate Revenue Committee. Is there anything else to come before this?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I ask permission to suspend the rules so that I may vote on Senate Bill 401.
Senator Metzger asks that rules be suspended so he can vote on Senate Bill 401. Is there any objection? If not, so ordered. Senator Metzger, how do you vote?
Aye.
Senator Metzger votes aye. I should have voted in the vote session. Okay. All right. Any other discussion? Any announcements for future meetings, Committee Administrator?
Chair Duncan, members of the committee, the meeting next week will be Thursday the 22nd rather than Friday. Friday is an in-district day.
Oh.
Okay, and would you also brief them just a bit so people can start mentally getting geared for the network discussion with students from throughout the state?
Sure. Chair Duncan, members of the committee, we're still working with Tom Cook and others to set up a Kids and Technology Day, a video conference where we will have the opportunity, or you as members will have the opportunity, to chat with students across the state about technology and how it's changing and what their views and visions are. Tentatively, it's scheduled for Friday the 30th. We're just double-checking on that now.
If you recall, this was Senator Courtney's idea that we ought to be listening to the young people. They have, conceptually, they can deal with all this much better than we older folk, and so we can possibly learn from them. So we're looking forward to that opportunity. Yes.
One other thing I'd like to mention. Representative Hill has invited this committee on a field trip of DAS IRMD for Tuesday the 27th, beginning at 2 p.m. I understand that most members of this committee are pretty busy at that time. However, I understand that HP is going to set up an office of the future that day in Hearing Room B, and it should be open all day. So I'll keep you posted.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other discussion? If not, the committee is adjourned. I'd like to thank the OHSU representatives and representatives from around the state for joining us today. We are adjourned.